do know who you are. I do know what I want. We have a very particular set of skills. Skills we've acquired over a certain amount of time. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you. So I will find you, and I will interview you for the Gaffer Tapes.
Give me your name and record.
Eric Samuelson. I was finance director and then chief executive of AFC Wimbledon for 17 years.
My goodness, and this is different. I've stopped doing the Gaffer Tapes with managers for COVID and now all sorts of different reasons. So, and I wanted to do this, so I've slid it in under the Gaffer Tape stuff, and we will try and get through as much as I want. And I would like to say to people, I'm delighted to be able to turn the tides on this.
I'm going to say, I was a gaffer. There's no problem in that.
Because I've sat in your office the other way around on a few occasions back in the day.
Yeah, I was always gentle with you.
Yes, I know. Well, we'll see. And I suppose really, and you know, we've an awful lot to get through, and we've a time period on it. But I'm going to let it run as long as it runs, or I want to try and get as much as I can. So we do have to start at the beginning. I don't mean your schooling or your... I mean the beginning of your love affair with Wimbledon, I suppose, before AFC Wimbledon.
Yeah, I'm from Sunderland. The people down here tell me I'm still a rough northerner. So I was supported them until we came to London. I still supported them. And then we got two sons, Peter and John, and... they went to a local school, and there's actually two different versions of the story, but either way, I ended up taking the elder one initially to see his local club, which was Wimbledon. We went to see them play at Arsenal, first ever game. We were dire, but he'd never been to a game before, he loved it. And so we started going and going and going. Eventually, we went to every game at home, then every game away. And then I can't watch a game without wanting somebody to win. I just can't. And eventually I thought, hang on, this is my team now. And that was it. So we sat behind the goal at... we went to Plough Lane about a dozen times, but we sat behind the goal at Selhurst mainly. Pete and I went to the cup final. And then I got... I used to go on... There's a chat site, doesn't exist anymore. I used to go on that. And I used to comment, since I'm an accountant... on some of the proclamations from Wimbledon FC about the finances behind the need to move to Milton Keynes as it became. And I used to comment and say, well, that doesn't make sense if you look at the accounts and this sort of stuff. I got to be known for that. And through that, I got to meet the leaders of the resistance to all this stuff, who some of whom became the people who founded AFC Wimbledon. So that was it, really.
Yeah, and... I suppose it's a period that I want to talk about it for a little bit, but that period at Selhurst Park and you know the move that was then going to go to Milton Keynes, was that the northerner in you that went, well, I'm definitely sticking my heels in here, I'm definitely going to get involved in it, or just how you've always been, I've always found it when you think it's wrong, you say so.
Yeah, I think there's that. I think there's the underdog bit. You know, I'll be honest, I couldn't have brought myself. I'd have a real problem if they'd decided to support Chelsea or Spurs. I liked the fact that it was Wimbledon and they're always constantly fighting, playing good football, better than people ever gave them credit for, but fighting to hold their own. So I liked that very much. But the reason I've got really quite close to the leaders of the resistance was one of my clients, an accountant, had bought the old Plough Lane. And they're about to demolish it because of asbestos risk or something. And the man there said to me, knowing I was a Wimbledon fan, would I like to go in with 20 or so fans and they could take anything they liked? So I got a bunch of fans and went with my youngest son this time. I remember him standing on this nettle and saying... I always wanted to stand on the centre spot here, but not like this.
Oh, wow, yeah, wow.
And the fans salvaged what they could. There wasn't much. And again, that put me closer to them. So when they all got started, I knew them. And I'd said to my boys, when it looked like, I thought from what Wimbledon was saying that they were going to be refused permission to go to Milton Keynes, would put themselves into administration, and that there would be a chance to buy them. So I wrote a business plan to buy them and run the club. And I remember saying to my boys, this is going to be really exciting because either we'll end up buying this club, and thank God we didn't because the business plan was absolutely garbage, or we'll have to start again. Either way, it's going to be exciting. And then they were allowed to go to Milton Keynes, and so we had to start again. And I approached the main people that I worked with, of the four founders. The four founders were Trevor Williams, Mark Jones, Ivor Heller and Chris Stewart. And the last two of those who went on to be directors of the club are the ones I just went up to and said, you need a finance director. And that's me, which is so unlike me. It really is so unlike me.
Where do you think that came from?
It came from seeing there's a role to be done, recognising that because I worked for what's now PwC, which is, I think, the biggest of the accounting and consultant firms in the world, gave a degree of credibility and seriousness that I thought, whether I personally deserve it or not, the fact that I was a partner there added that to it. And actually, I was 54 and looking to think, what am I going to do next? Because I've had enough at PwC. I want to stop. So for 18 months, I continued at PwC, working on the football in my office there. There's the old joke, how many people work here? And the answer is over half of them. Well, I was one of the other half. And then it just got silly. So I said to Eileen, my wife, I'm going to offer to put more time in, but I promise you I won't spend all my time there. And I promise you I won't spend my pension. You get a fairly generous pension from my time there. And I lied about the first of that. So from the end of December 2003, I was pretty well full time. But the big step was me going out of character and saying, you need somebody. Yeah. And I was talking to Ivor about this, and he said, we needed someone. You were credible. We're in a hurry. Not particularly flattering, but, you know, we're in the right place at the right time. Yeah, we'll have you.
Wow.
It was as simple as that. And because they weren't at the time owned by the fans, just Chris and Ivor had set up the company, they could do what they liked, and they did.
Yeah, and probably importantly that they did, because you needed to move quick. And I've always, I didn't realise you were in that early. I thought you came along a little bit.
I always described myself as half a yard behind them. I'm not one of the four founders, but I was there.
Half the world's half a yard behind Ivor.
Well, absolutely. He's the one everybody remembers, isn't he?
Yeah, but I think as well that at that time, I've always been interested, and we've talked about it different, but, you know, yes, you're an expert in your field, and Chris does what he does in that. But you have no idea about football clubs or leagues or any of that.
No, nonsense. I mean, Trevor Williams is the expert. Trevor always said that he's going to write a book saying, I was there too, you. Because he always gets forgotten. And actually, he's still at the heart of it all now. He's a great guy.
Oh, I love him to bits.
Lovely man. And he'd actually been to lots of non-league games. I'd never been to a non-league game. My boys went. They went to Tooting, Sandy Lane, and they went to Kingstonian. But I'd never been. And, excuse me. Trevor was therefore the expert, knew everything to do. I mean, he had a little more idea than us. But when you stop and think about it, we're forming a club, what do we need? Well, we probably need to join the FA, and we need to find a league, we need a ground, we need a manager, we need some players, and we need some kit. And it's not that hard. Actually doing it's not particularly easy, but listing the main things you want is a piece of cake, really.
Yeah.
So Trevor knew the Ryman League looked like the right place to go. So I think it was Ivor or Chris rang them up and spoke to the then secretary, Nick Robinson. I think Nick was the one who told us he'd got to get in the London FA. So David Folkes came along and fortunately was Wimbledon fan would be too strong, but an admirer of Wimbledon. And he was the secretary of the Wimbledon District League or some such thing. So he was the one who said, we've got to get you at the right level, otherwise you'll end up playing on Tooting Beck Common. And can you imagine that with all those fans? So, and all that just happened at a hell of a rush. I mean, we got the decision on the 28th of May, although Ivor was told the day before. And the application for the Ryman League was the 17th of June.
Yeah.
It was a problem because it wasn't 21 days and our application needed 21 days notice, which is why we failed.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
So they were just working like, not like madmen, they're working very methodically, but very hard. And I was ringing up anybody I knew associated with the football saying, what do I need to do?
Yeah, to find, to learn on your feet. And I always think about the characters within that group because I've got to know them all. They're all very, very, yourself, Aver. And how do you put them in a room and get success?
Well, Ivor always says that Christian was immense at the time. He was more energetic and active than he'd ever seen him before. And he drove a lot of stuff through. Mark is the creative guy. He's a, I don't know if he's genuinely a designer, but he designed the badge, the strip. Year in, year out, he won the Design the Kid competition, even when he put it in under another name. He always won. And Trevor was a bloke who knew about non-league football, and effectively, despite the fact he kept wandering around saying, I need to get a job, he just left Barclays, didn't like it. Ended up, you're club secretary.
That was it. Yeah.
And he read the books. And there's lots of people who want to help you. I mean, when you're doing something as romantic and idiotic and idealistic as this, lots of people say, and also some very senior people like David Bernard, who was the chief executive of the old Wimbledon FC, who was by then a director or club secretary at Chelsea.
Yeah.
So you get people... Yeah, I'm going
to
help.
Yeah, I don't think everybody gets people. I always felt that the media, how the club got the media on board was exceptional compared to any other non-league club. Maybe that's to do with the size of the support.
Well, there's a lot of experience, you see, because they've done a very sophisticated opposition campaign to the initial, among others, desire to go to Dublin. Dublin Dons was a real thing. It got quite close. And then Milton Keynes. So it's quite sophisticated. And there's a lot of highly qualified people, including some people who work in the press, some people who work in PR. So they work in the background to get the press involved and the media generally. So when a big meeting took place, I think it was 2 days after the announcement, it happened that the Independent Supporters Association had a meeting scheduled for the 30th of May. Sky... a couple of other TV channels were there, plus all the local press, because of the contacts that who'd been working on their opposition. Well, that's how I read it, anyway.
Yeah.
So that plus, oh, blimey, this is a good story, isn't it?
Oh, it's a massive story. I want to go back to one, because I'm talking about the group of people who, again, yourself, Aver, Chris, Trevor, and Jonesy. And the word I've put down here is fights. Because every time you speak to people like yourself or anybody else representing the club, myself included, it would be said when I was there, we're very good at telling people the right stuff, but there must have been situations where you were all in the one room where disagreement would, if you any...
Yes, but I don't remember them in the early days. I mean, there were arguments and...
Let us into a couple of them if you can.
Well,
I'm interested in how the characters work in the room.
Years on, many years on.
Yeah.
We were 2009, so the end of our seventh season. We've been promoted to the conference, from the Conference South into the Conference National. I'm going to use the old terms because that's what was in place.
It's fine by me.
It's the Ryman League, the conference.
Fine by me.
And we had been talking for some time. We had this campaign that we needed a stadium in Merton. We wanted to go back to Merton. We had no right at all to have that. We had no money. We had nothing to offer. But we just kept saying it and people seemed to believe us. But whenever we approached Merton Council, their answer would be classic sort of politicians handoff of, fine, come and show us what you want to do and we'll talk to you about it. Which was useless, really. But then they had ludicrously in my view, they had a civic reception for us. After we won the Conference South. And at that meeting, by which time I was the chief executive, Ivor was talking to some of the councillors, and it was all, how can we get you into it? What do we have to do? So he came back and reported this to a board meeting. I was at the same do, and nobody spoke to me about it. I'm the chief executive.
Yeah.
But of course, Ivor's the one they all know, quite rightly. So I was saying, I don't believe you. I think they make it up. I think this is just hype, Ivor. You know, it's enthusiasm. I don't believe it. And we had the closest we've ever been to a massive row about it. And then someone else at the meeting independently told me, this is what they're saying. I thought, oh, I grovelled to Ivor. Really. I don't like
He'll have enjoyed that.
Oh, he would.
Yeah.
There's that.
So what, they keep it, listen, you know, I've been in a room with two people picking 11 players to go on a football pitch and had arguments. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a healthy thing. Did you all know your own box then? So financially then
there's sort of. I mean, Chris was initially appointed as chairman. Chris and I have set the club up. They were the two directors, the £2 company. They sold it to the Don's Trust for £2 in 20p coins from the woman who handed over her parking meter money and meet in the middle of London. And so then was owned by the Don's Trust, which had been set up before the club. It was set up to try and influence Wimbledon FC. And then a few months later, we own a football club.
Wow. Blimey,
we don't know. Wow. What do we do? So, I've forgotten the question.
The question was the fights, but you've moved on well.
Well, the main fights actually were between the Don's Trust board, a group of people who were elected democratically to create this organisation to try and eventually get a place on the Wimbledon FC board. And that was, I think, launched in the February 2002. And sometime early in June, I've forgotten the exact date of it, for £2, they bought a football club. And so they were in a position that they weren't elected for and they didn't necessarily have the right skills for. And what I've always found, with all due respect to people who worked really hard and sat through incredibly long meetings, was that when you're a volunteer, you tend to gravitate to what you know rather than what you should be doing. So you could talk to Eileen about the number of times I came home spitting feathers about another bloody meeting that gone on all night and achieved nothing.
Yeah.
And those are the places where the friction was.
Yeah.
And when I was at PwC, one of its predecessor organisations, there was a mantra that we had, which is that the best people can make crap systems work and the worst people can ruin the best systems. So what happened was, although the system didn't work very well, Ivor and Chris, and less publicly, but Mark and Trevor, just got on with it. And then went back and told the trust what we were doing.
Yeah.
And after about a year, the trust board, I think, realised that perhaps they ought to give the fans a chance to decide if they're the right people. So they had another election, which I thought was very altruistic of them, the right thing to do. And then we started to move towards a more business-based, focused board.
But effectively, you ended up setting up a module that is any fans club would go to now.
Well, yeah, I mean, people say, are you the model for the future of fans clubs? Well, first of all, only if you want your club stolen off you and taken up the M1 leaving fans behind. And secondly, there was already in existence an organisation called Supporters Direct, which many listeners will know, which is set up by the Mayor of Manchester now, Andy Burnham. And one of our fans worked for them. So they had a pro forma constitution that the Don's Trust basically adopted. Doesn't quite fit what we needed to do, but it was, you know, flying start. So that was all in place already, and you had people, you know, couldn't wait to come to the door and advise and help us. But they were best of intentions, very effective. And that got them going and helped them get better organised.
Brilliant. Okay, let's move on to the football stuff, I suppose. We'll dip in and out of different stuff.
Sure.
But I'm not trained for this stuff, as you know, but I'm interested in, okay, Terry Eames becomes your first manager. What was the process in that? And just briefly, how involved were you in it?
I wasn't involved in that at all. My favourite story about recruitment was of a different guy called Luke McKenzie.
Yeah.
You may have come across him. He was a steward for probably while you were there.
Yeah.
And he says, and Ivor agrees, that one day Ivor rang him up and said, you're a big lump, we want you to be our chief steward. and he knew nothing about it. He said, yeah, okay, fine.
I'm glad I didn't bump into him then. I could end up a chief steward.
You might have done.
And that's how he went with it.
Yeah, he did. He was chief steward for years, and a very good one too.
I must have bumped into him, but with Terry, you've trials.
Terry had been one of the people. He's a former Wimbledon player. I think he was a left back, but it's before my time.
Yeah,
and he'd actually joined in the protests and turned up for them with his wife, who had been a secretary at the club, I think. So he was already known to all the key people, and they knew. That he knew non-league. He'd managed a couple of clubs, and I can't remember the names, but he had. So he was there helping and advice. He knew a couple of grounds we might play at, although in the end we went to a different one, but he still, you know, he knew people at Dulwich, he knew people at Leatherhead.
Yeah.
And he was the obvious choice, and so Chris and or Ivor appointed him as director of football.
Director of football, not manager?
Director of football. And he turned up to that meeting that I think it was the second meeting we had in the community hall in St George's Road in Wimbledon. And he was announced as director of football, and he stood up. I mean, he played it beautifully, you know. I think he said if he met Charles Coppell, who was running the Wimbledon FC and moving it, he'd punch him. I think he said that. And then he said, we're going to win the league. We're going to get promotion. A beautiful little pause before him. Because the place was in uproar.
Brilliant.
And he knew players, and actually, I suspect it was his idea, although all the best ideas have lots of parents.
Yes.
But the idea of having trials on Wimbledon Common, I assume, was a football man's idea. So it would be Terry's. I don't know, but it seems reasonable.
Yeah.
And, you know, people think trials on Wimbledon Common would jump us for goalposts. There's 9 pitches on Wimbledon Common extension off the A3. So they're not great pitches, but they were pitches. So there he was. He was director of football. He stepped down from that about a year later to focus on the first team and I think the youth under-18s or something. I've forgotten the detail.
Yeah.
But that's how he got it. And he went off and we gave him a budget of £700 a week. Well, he told us he needed £700 a week. He turned up with a spreadsheet with names on it, including Simon Bassey, who was there for 17 years.
Oh, we'll come back to him. Yeah. Don't worry about that.
And I added it up, and it added up to £700, and I thought, well, you're on.
Yeah.
And that was it. And of course, what happened was, I did some sums, because, you know, the accountant, we can't help it. I think in the... I mean, it's not being in the Ryman League, it ended up in the Seagrave Haulage Combined Counties League, it was called at the time. Yeah. But I think that at that time, if you took that league and the Ryman League 2, and probably the Ryman at that level, there's about 2,000 players playing these various, probably about 80 teams, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
And I reckon 1,900 of them, 1,950, were out of contract. You know, they're on 7-day registration.
Yeah, absolutely. You can say who you want.
About half of them applied to, you know, sometime or other. It felt like they're all at the door saying, can I come?
Yeah.
So at the training ground, Trevor just couldn't keep up with the emails coming in. So the Wimbledon Common. And we had, numbers vary, but the warm-up run they did looks just like the start of the London Marathon. It really does. There's photos of it.
And to be fair to Terry, you know, I don't think I've ever met Terry Eames, but to take it from that to a starting 11 is a real achievement. Well, you know,
what he did was he had various coaches there. I'm convinced he didn't even know them all. Because, you know, blimey, what's going on here? And by the end of the day, he whittled it down to 60. Well, as Trevor says, you know, such a circus. And I don't mean that's a critical of anybody.
Yeah.
There's so many people. I mean, there's people there who could barely stand on one leg and swing the other. But they can say, I trialled for FC Wimbledon.
Yes, yes.
And I thought, I should have done that. I could say it.
Yeah.
I nearly got a place, yeah. And he'd whittled it down to 60, and then they had further trials.
Yeah.
And come the Sutton game, which I think was July the 12th, somewhere around then, our first ever game. He had a start in 18.
Yeah.
And they did the Sven-Göran Eriksson thing at half-time. You know, most of the players got switched over.
Yeah.
And that was how he got going. He had an assistant manager and he had a coach, although they rotated quite quickly too. And off we went. And I think the thing we didn't realise, none of us realised was, even in that league, you didn't need a lot of money to make a big difference to a team.
Yeah. You know,
if we're on 700 quid a week, that was probably above average.
I would say so, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
So AFC Wallingford, and with Dean 2000, the big names.
Yeah.
By the time we realised that they were spending more than us, we couldn't catch them.
Yeah.
At the end of that season, we got 111 points.
And didn't get promoted?
Came third. There was only one promotion, but if the top team didn't have a suitable ground, and they didn't, then the second team did. And if they didn't have a suitable ground, nobody got promoted.
I remember, we were third. Yeah, yeah.
So that was it, 111 points.
And his downfall?
Sorry?
Terry's downfall? Were you involved in that?
I'll say this now because I don't want to keep going on, but I've written a book about the club, from beginning to opening the new stadium. And Terry was sacked, but we agreed at the hearing, which ended up with that we would effectively, there's no paper there, but we signed a non-disclosure agreement.
Well, that's
so fine. All I've done in the book that I've written is talk about what happened afterwards.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he's a guy, 23 games into a season, 122, drawn one.
And gets sacked.
He got sacked. And you can understand the fans were terribly nice, our fans, but bemused is the least of it.
Well, I would say so, yeah.
It's very aggressive and unpleasant.
Yeah.
And that was where I was lucky, because I was just the other guy. Nobody really knew who I was.
Yeah.
Chris and Ivor were the public faces of it. And they, the day he was sacked on the Wednesday, on the Saturday we played Chessington at Leatherhead's ground. And Nicky English, who'd been helping with the reserves, took over. And I went, sort of stood on the side, because I don't like being in the seat, so I can avoid it. And Ivor and Chris went into the bar and did all the things you do as directors. And we're on the same end of some pretty unpleasant.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that, you know, and that goes with the unfortunately goes with the territory when you're in that. And I understand that you were the guy that day who was the other guy, but then there comes a time when you're the guy, and so we just jumped to it. How did you? Because people think you're not human when you're in a dugout as a manager or you're a director, where they feel it's their given right to give you abuse. And I've always sort of laughed it off. It's never bothered me. Do you remember the first time it was you? And how did you deal with it?
Abuse. I mean, I got far more abuse from my children than I ever got from the football ground. But, you know, they were teenagers, wouldn't expect. Actually, they're a bit older than that, come to think of it.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, listen, don't dodge the question.
No, I'm not, but I mean, one of the things is, and it's, well, first of all, I was doing it for nothing. There's this thing about
a guinea a year, so I remember
that was because you're supposed to have a contract. They wanted me to have a contract. For a contract, that has to be, I think it's called an exchange of value or something. Mm-hmm. So normally it's a pound, like when you have a peppercorn rent, it's normally a pound.
Yeah.
And I just said, pound sounds a bit normal, let's have a guinea. You know, as I like to say, I had a good agent. And so because I was working for nothing, there's no point at all people saying, put some more money in. If you want more money in it, put it in. It's your club, not mine.
Yeah.
Secondly,
but effectively, sorry, you're now spending their money.
Oh yeah. But you know, as you know, you're part of it. We went 78 games without losing.
Yeah.
It's not difficult for the fans to be happy then.
Yeah.
You know, I was bored, but it was just too easy. But I know it got tougher in the Ryman.
Yeah, the Premier
Ryman one. I think we defended last, wasn't it?
Yeah, we lost. Yeah.
But the other thing was, I you can call it my belief I could do any job better than other people. Some people would say that. Others was, I just thought we all ought to do something. You may remember I used to run the car park.
I do indeed. I remember it well.
The visiting officials and the sponsors and eventually the players' car park. So again, if anybody wanted to complain, they all had to walk past me coming into the ground. Don't say you can't get hold of me. I'm standing there.
Yeah.
as Ivor would have had it if he had his way, in a little peaked cap.
And I won't name him because I don't think it's relevant, but I remember a story of a very well-known footballer at the time, well, retired, who'd come in from a club and was complaining about his parking space. And your line was, do you want to speak to the chairman? But he said no. Oh, do you remember that?
I'm so disappointed. And I turned around and turned around with a big smile. Can I help you?
Yeah. Yeah, no,
that was a big disappointment. But anyway, the way I tell it in the book is it's like that. And then there's a footnote saying, well, that wasn't really. If it was a film ever made, it would be like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think... And I know the character as well, so I thought you were quite brave as well.
One of the things I treasure most about the club was, I will come on to how I became chief executive, but when I became chief executive and was finally formally appointed after being acting CEO for a while, not to my knowledge, the club programme headline, car park attendant appointed chief executive. And when I retired, eventually I said, I don't want anything, thank you. I certainly don't want a shirt. But what I would like is a framed copy of that programme page.
Yes, that.
Because I thought it was genius.
It is genius.
I wish I'd thought of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I haven't got that yet because I think COVID, whatever, it's somewhere at the club, but I'll get it someday. But I ran on as finance director for a while, and by and large our roles were known. Chris was the chairman. Chris was very strategic, a good thinker, very bright, able man. Ivor was the commercial director, running around rabble-rousing, selling stuff, energetic, right out in the community. Trevor was the club secretary, and Mark was a bit more in the background, from my point of view anyway.
Yeah.
But if you wanted anything doing, presentation stuff, I discovered the best time to go to Mark is sending him an email at 1 a.m, he's probably still working, and you'd get it back when you get out of bed the next morning. So they were doing that, but Chris and Ivor were, although Ivor had a full-time job, Chris had just been made redundant.
Yes.
So they were based at the stadium, and gradually I was more and more. Eventually, I think one of the things I realised as I wrote the book, and I think if I'd stopped, I'd have known it, the further we got on, the less fun it got. The more you had to lose, perhaps a better way of putting it. And I think it got to the stage where Chris just found, that's enough for me.
Yeah.
And... announced he wanted to step down. And I went to a board meeting soon after where they quickly realised he was serious.
He
didn't come, but he was busy drafting his resignation statement. And they appointed me as acting CEO, in quotes, for now.
And
I thought, no one else is having this job.
No, no.
So I made it very difficult for them to appoint anybody else.
Yeah, my memory of it is that it was absolutely the right time. You know, as changing managers, I think the club got that right more than they didn't. But I thought that when Chris stood down and you took the job, it was during my reign. It didn't make it an easier role for me, but I thought it was the right time. And I thought it by then, you knew it was for you.
I wanted to do it. People who don't know me, indeed some who do, would find this hard to believe, but it was so out of character to me for me to say, I want this job and you're going to give it to me. Not quite in those words, but you've got no choice. You really do need to give this to me.
Why do you feel like that?
Blimey, I'm not sure I should tell you this. when I was at school a few years ago, I got called into the headmaster's study and he said to me something on the lines of, whenever they're looking for you, you're the one who never takes responsibility. And I spent the next 50-odd years trying to live that down.
Is that right?
Putting myself forward, thinking, it's my responsibility. If there's something gone wrong, I'm in charge. I'll take the blame. You know, I've got people working for me, and I'll talk to them about it, but I'm in ultimate charge. And it did it badly. It did it horribly. I was very upset. But actually, it changed my life. And it flowed all the way through there. I mean, it took me a long time to get into the stage where I was quite pushy about it, but it was a big message.
Mm. Yeah, and that, I mean, I look back at that time and I think, if not you, who? And, you know, listen, you know, we've always got on okay, but, You know, we, I'm not, one thing I like to say is we're quite honest. I thought, if not you, you who? And it was absolutely the right thing. But I was more wanted today is, why did you think that? You know, why did you? So the thing goes back to your school, and that's brilliant. But there must be more to it than just a headmaster 107 years ago.
Well, you know, when I was, I worked for PwC. I'm not rich, especially after working for nothing for 17 years. But you get paid a lot of money compared to most people.
Yeah.
At a job like that, and so I knew I could afford to retire on the pension they were paying me. And you get to 54 and you think, actually, what they're paying me is not a motivator anymore. I need to do something different. What could it be? And I thought, I love football. Non-executive director of a football club. I start asking around and thinking, never going to get it. Yeah. I'm not senior enough in this place. I, you know, mid-rank. But
yeah.
And then this came up and I thought, and I dived into it in the way that sort of the semi-obsessional way I dive into most things.
Yes, I've seen that. I've seen that, yeah.
Which from, often from gets printing tickets. Done, but sometimes is a problem for everybody, including me.
Yeah.
And then once I started doing it, it was, there's all sorts of things. This was wrong. This was just absolutely wrong what happened there. It needed putting right. It was exciting. It was fun. You know, you ended up, I think the season after you went, you have a guy that I stood on the terrace of admiring from afar, Marcus Gale, coming in,
yeah,
kissing her on the cheek, asking how her knee is. And you think, this isn't real.
Yeah, this is.
So it's not the glory bit, because what you realise very quickly is, although biologically compared to me, they're geniuses, they're just people.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to manage them. But it was great to be so close to it. And if you can't play,
yeah,
if you can't do teach, if you can't play football,
yeah,
be an administrator.
No, be a referee, I was taught.
Well, yeah. But when your side goes, you become a referee.
Yeah. That hasn't changed either. But I think, yeah, and that makes sense to me. But all of a sudden it takes you, you know, when you talk about the guy who doesn't turn up, it now puts you proper front middle. As chairman of the football club, a high profile club that was a massive. Well, I always say, look, at that time the biggest club in non-league. So now you're fronting that with a character that actually I always felt you were comfortable with it. You pretended not to be.
There's a facade I put on. Actually, it's not a facade. It's the real me most of the time, but not always, of the conservative, boring accountant. There's a guy who wrote a book about our first season. It never got published, but he showed me all the drafts. And he does a brilliant takedown of me tearing my hair out after Simon Bassey got sent off in a game, in a cup game, when it could cost us all this money. You know, because I used to watch these games, and before you settle down in the game, what's the crowd? What's the money like to be? You know, how's it going to affect our results? That always was something I'd think about. So when Simon got sent off and we were winning 1-0 at Pagham, it was, down in Sussex, is that?
It is, yes, yeah.
And I was thinking, oh. And the guy does it very well, asterisks all over the place, and if he costs us, you know, if he costs us £500.
yeah.
Different scale of money now, yeah. But it was...
Oh, same because formula.
It only cost you that. It cost you the share of the gate from the next round, the possible prize in the next round. So the accountant in me was constantly focusing on that. But there was always, we need to take some risks if we want to get to places. And we did take some fairly hefty risks at various times during my time. Some of them where we all but bet the shop.
Yeah.
About over the new stadium in particular.
Yes.
And I was always... My view was always, let's get all the facts, let's analyse them, let's discuss them as a group. If we can all agree on it, and it turns out to be wrong, well, we did everything we could to get it right.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to, well, I will beat myself up, but I can't think of anything else I could have done.
No.
So that, and then, you know, and sell it to the Donsworth board, because there's only twice, I think, they overruled us.
Yeah.
So there's that, but very rarely... And there's a self-effacing bit, you know. But actually, that is more me. And one of the differences between Ivor and me is Ivor revels, I think, in the give him a microphone.
Absolutely, yeah.
I quite enjoy it.
Yeah.
But I don't seek it.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that's fair. I would say that yes, I'd say that's fair. I want to get away from that and get onto the decent stuff, the sort of the stuff that. But managers have wrote down here, you know, I want to flip through each manager, you know, don't think they spend a lot of time on me, but I'm interested in your opinions of.
I never did spend much time.
Yeah, certainly not when we're doing a contract, I know that much. But,
what
you know,
was it you said? A full-time job for part-time pay.
Yeah, yeah, I was right and all that, we tell you.
You got away with that.
Yeah, but if we just try and flip through them, and I'm worried of time, but I don't want to rush any of it, you know. But we'll do a couple, and then I'm going to have a tea break, so we'll pause it. No, but
fine.
People don't need to know that. So we spoke about Terry and the fact that we can't speak about Terry, and then it was Nicky.
But no, I mean, the thing I would say about Terry was what he did was in the pre-season friendly. I think we had 10 pre-season friendlies. I know there are still T-shirts around. You know, the pop groups, rock groups have on the back all the days.
Yes.
Well, they're still around. I'm not sure if they're the fixtures or the results. I can't remember. The bright yellow. But we lost the first 9.
Wow.
Because he said, quite astutely and quite rightly, everybody's going to want to beat us. All our pre-season friendlies are going to be against teams much higher up.
Yeah.
And we eventually won the 10th one against Enfield Town, I think it was, before we had our first serious game. I thought that was shrewd.
Yeah.
The second thing was, it wasn't difficult to attract players, and to attract players better than the money we paid them, because, you know, you used to play in front of 50 to 100. I remember you coming to meet the manager and seeing more than you usually had watching.
Yeah, yeah, more.
And so you didn't have to pay the top whack for these players because they wanted to play. They wanted people to ask them for their autographs. They wanted people with their name on the back of their shirt. And so by the time of the second season, when we had that run that he had, we had players who were at least good enough for one division above. And you had Joe Shearer, who played for Chelsea, albeit only for 10 minutes.
Great lad.
Where it was.
Great lad. 10 minutes more than most, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and funny enough, it was against Wimbledon. He placed Zola on the pitch. That's not a bad claim to fame, is it?
No.
So you had all these guys with fantastic talents, and as one of them said to me, but with, not quite in these words, but there's something lacking. Ambition, desire, drive, discipline.
Yeah.
But so he had a team that, and I don't mean this to demean him in any way, but he had a team that could almost play itself, because I think any footballer worth his salt can go out and play 4-4-2. You don't need to tell them.
If you're a level above, and yeah, no, I get that. And the selling the club, I mean, to my own team, I'd had an actual video of the big stand at Woking when we played the cup final that was rammed to the roof with people. And I used to say to people, do you want 20 quid more? Do you want this?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's an easy sell, you know, but you know, effectively, when you're getting the right people, they want the 20 quid more on you know,
yeah,
so
the wages eased up and ratcheted up.
How did you go about that? You know, just as a, you know, because every manager worth their salt will be trying to get a bit more
for
their budget. No, yeah.
I think, I mean, we didn't honestly know what we were doing, so when you look back at it, of those players at the peak of Terry's time with us, probably only two we needed to put on a contract. That's Joe Shearer, ex-Chelsea player.
Yep.
Possibly still the best technical player we've ever had.
Yeah,
not
great.
Far off if he isn't. And Matt Everard, who...
Big Matt.
Centre-half has scored 37 goals.
absolutely.
You know, I think one every two games it was.
Yeah.
And the rest of them, but Terry got them contracts. And I think we needn't have done that.
Yeah.
He was looking after his players. That's part of his job. But we really didn't need that.
52 weeks as well, is that right?
Oh, no.
There was talk, because when I remember my first interview, or maybe they were talking about contracts, and they said to me about, this is in the little chef, and they said to me about 52 weeks.
I think one or two players did.
Yeah.
Maybe the Joes and the Mats.
Maybe. It's just something that stuck in my head a wee bit.
I remember when we first were going, in that first season, we signed a player, doesn't matter which one, and he got injured, or was he sent off? Either way, he couldn't play. We didn't pay him when he wasn't playing, let alone 52 weeks. That was how we did it.
That's well, that's the way it was at that
level. There was 36, 37, 38 weeks.
Yeah.
I think as we moved up, it moved up in the conference, it moved up to 44. Still,
yeah.
Even when we were full-time, it's only full-time for 44 weeks.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I think there were a couple who were probably all year round, but I think it was the...
They were worth it.
Yeah.
And just sort of skipping along, you go, you know, Terry, then Nicky comes after Terry. Just briefs, goods, bads, and different, you know, just your...
Nicky, I mean, you 21 games in the league, won 18, drew 3, won the cup, so he got the league and cup double and didn't get the job.
Yeah.
When you look at it, he should have been a shoo-in to any outsider. But we made it very clear. And he did a good job. He stood in when we needed him to. He got those results.
Was it just down to the fact of experience for what was coming next?
We wanted someone who would take us through the next two leagues, and we could see that Nicky would probably get us through the next league, but we weren't sure about the one above.
Yeah,
and
sure the next guy did that other actually.
<say. laughs> we thought he might be able to.
Yeah.
He interviewed and didn't get the job. And I go into this quite a lot in the book. And he took it incredibly badly, and I would have done too.
Mm-hmm.
But we kept him on as under 18 manager, which he agrees with what we rapidly decided was we shouldn't have done that.
We all agree that, don't we? I mean, I agreed to it at the time.
At the time. No,
and to be fair, at the time, I agreed to it because I wanted the job. But I think in hindsight, it was a bad idea from all of us. Although I've read Nicky's bit in the book, and you know, I like to have a beer with him sometime,
it's a really powerful piece.
It is, it really is, yeah.
The lessons he's learned and what he wished he'd done. Yeah. I think it's very impressive, a really impressive man for that in that respect. Yeah.
And I think that's important for managers. We were just talking about it before we recorded about having some experience around you to maybe point you in that direction. Mm. But listen, I've no issue. And I didn't want to make it about that. You know, and then so I come in then.
You bluffed your way through.
I bluffed my way through for 3 years and effectively underachieved in the last one. With some bad luck, I think, with injuries, that'll always be my fallback.
Yeah, bad luck in the
playoff
in the second year, when we had first team on the bench. And
yeah.
Fisher was such a rich club, they could afford to lend a player to a team two leagues above
them. Who tortured us that night.
He did.
It
was
Leroy.
Striker. Leroy
Griffiths.
Yeah, good player. Yeah. Scored, I think.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the game, we also had our two centre-backs that game taken off.
Yeah.
So it was we did well to lose 2-1.
And then
the following playoff.
Wes gets sent off, didn't he? Wes Daly gets sent off. But I think when I look back, you know, and I don't want to stick on me, I really don't. I'd underachieve with it. You know, when I'm a bit like Nicky, when I look at Parker, go, it's a difficult league to get out of, but we should have got out of it.
I mean, you and I have discussed this before, and the sense I got of it was that coming from Hendon, who, lovely, Graham, lovely people there, good club, where you weren't on the best budget and set up, indeed, as Terry did at Hayes, Terry Brown, before he moved on to Aldershot, set up not to lose first. It must be difficult to come to a place where you think, actually, I need to set up to win. It must be a difficult change.
It is, yeah. And I think it's something that, with experience, we'd do everything different. You start to feel about your finances. You're getting at the club that are essential to your mortgage, and you become negative. And a goalkeeper, I'm negative anyway. But listen, we'd some good times, me and you, and with Chris, and we'd some arguments, and I always, the one thing I'd say about you, I felt I could bully Chris, you know, and I'll be honest, I felt I could push him into a corner. I never ever felt that with you. But I also felt as well, Eric, and maybe you want to talk about this a bit, not so much with me, but with other managers, is me and you would have heated debates about different subjects. And I always remember complimentary tickets being one of them, where I'd be going, I wanted 6 because the manager going, well, I'm the chairman, and I don't get any. I remember all that stuff, but you always had you always had the ability to whatever the argument or the agreement was to put that, file it, and go on to the next subject with a clean head. Did that come out of your profession, or did it just come out of your character?
When I worked at PwC as a predecessor firm, but for simplicity, I worked in the department which gave advice. They used to put anybody, if you overheard something over the phone, somebody, one of us giving advice over the phone, it would put on a piece of paper and stuck on the notice board. And one of mine apparently was on the lines of something like, "No, I'm not debating it with you. I'm right." I said, "Well, actually, it did happen, so I can't complain about it." Whereas I tried to. I mean, the thing about complimentary tickets was we had one stand of seats, so something like 800 seats before expended it, and we had next to none, and yeah. Nobody wants complimentary seats standing on a crappy terrace, complimentary places.
Yeah.
So we struggled with it. And I was thinking, you know, you want a better team. We need as much money as we can get from selling the tickets.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that's just a specific. I like to come to consensus decisions. It's very rarely that I can remember, you can ask other board members, in a board meeting where at the end I just said, right, okay, thanks very much. This is how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
I like to have a debate and a discussion and get input from bright people about how to do things. So that's what I tried to do with you. And really, my role with you was more a case of challenging why you wanted to recruit a particular player.
Yeah.
You know, you say you want to play, I don't know, I'm making this up, 4-3-3, so why do you want a right winger?
Yeah.
What do you want one of them for?
Yeah.
And I wanted the answer to the classic Ferguson question, Brian Clough question was, so what's this player's problem? Women gambling on money.
Yeah, yeah.
Or drink, sorry,
yeah.
So, you know, because we discussed how some of the players came in and could not handle it.
Yeah, no.
From 60 to in front of 3,000.
And that was always a thing. And I think when Terry took over, he still had to deal with it. But as Terry moved the team through the divisions, then it became normal.
And he'd done it before because for very different reasons. Aldershot went to the very bottom of the pile.
Yeah.
And he took them from there. So
yeah.
Similar size crowds, similar tradition in many ways.
Yeah.
And he took them up into the conference and nearly into the league.
Yeah.
So, when he applied for the job, you know, I've done this before. Very yeah. powerful message.
Pros and cons, likes.
Well, Terry came to us. He'd resigned from Aldershot because his wife Susie was very ill, and she's fine. She's fine today now. This was 2009. No, eight, seven, 2007. Sorry,
yeah.
Blimey. So he was available and needing to work, and she was encouraging him to get back to it. So he was his approach was, I've done this before. Not as simple as that, but that was that. He said, what about Stuart Cash, who had applied for the job when you got it?
Yeah.
And we'd nut him down as someone for the future, but not then. And they were very good. They were very impressive. They knew the team well. I discovered later because Bass had briefed them.
Yeah, and me. I'd spoke
Terry
to them.
Terry had listened completely, so he raved about Mickey Haswell's right foot. And after a while, I said, well, he's left-footed.
He's left.
And he decided to shut up. And actually, we weren't able to offer them a good enough budget, and they went away. I could see from the look on his face, thinking they're going to have to reject it. And then Mike Richardson, who has very benevolently, philanthropically sponsored the club over the years, supported the club, threw in some more money, and Terry took the job. What he brought in the first year was what he thought he needed to win the Ryman, or get out the Ryman, which was strength, physique. We weren't very pretty, and we scraped up, but he made it work. And then he went to, and Simon said he knew him when he was at Hayes, and he said he was just, well, as Terry put it, we played six centre-halves and we started off by not losing. We were big and ugly and horrible to play against. But he changed at Hayes, and once we went to the Conference South, we played football. His recruitment was good, and I think a lot of credit for that goes to Stuart as well as Simon.
Yeah.
Stuart knew his players at that level, Simon too. Stuart was very good in that respect, but his solution too frequently was another player.
Yeah.
Terry, I think, you know, he's a manager, his job to look after the budget. Terry just was a very good manager, a good tactician, and people wanted to play for him. And we played good football. In the Conference South, it was unbelievable. we ran away with our league, really.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of games and yeah, excellent, really good. I think they played the Diamond that year.
We did. The first game was away at Newport, a big, strong team.
I was there, yeah.
Promotion favourites. And John Main, who has a great conversation, which is in the book, which is he rings up his former manager saying, I don't know what to do. He can't head it. He can't trap it. He's not a leader of the line. He hasn't got a trick. And the bloke says to him, do you want someone to score your 40 goals?
Yeah.
We'll sign him. And that's what he did. Couldn't head the ball. He's got one of the best headed goals I've ever seen.
That day, yeah. Well, I always remember with me and he, I remember Joey Francis at Cray, where me and he was, before we signed Richard Butler. I said, what does he do? He says, he scores goals. I says, well, is he this? He says, that's all he kept saying to me, and we didn't sign him.
Yeah.
But then it cost the club a few quid because Brownie signed him, didn't he?
Didn't cost that much, but yes, it did. £20,000, I think.
Money well spent.
Absolutely. Anyway, he got injured, but he came back in time for the Wembley game. Actually, funnily enough, the friendly against Kensington Casuals, scored a wonderful goal in the playoff semi final, and you know, saw us through. Then next season was his best season. Goes into the conference, and Terry got us to something like eighth, I think, in the league that season, part-time, one of the few part-time teams. And I remember getting at the conference and looking at the teams there and thinking, wow, these are proper teams.
Yeah.
No disrespect to the others, but he played Mansfield and Luton, because of the dreadful decisions that were made to deduct 30 points off them. They had no chance of staying up. So you're playing really proper Football League teams. I think there's 13 teams in the league that year who were Football League teams or were about to be. So I never understood how we're going to get out of that league. And Terry took a big gamble. First of all, he persuaded me to go full-time on the grounds that you're going to have to do it sometime while you're waiting. A persuasive argument. Yeah. He was very good with me. He used to sort of work me. And I would sort of, this disembodied part of me would watch from the back of the room thinking, you're doing well, you're doing this really well, Terry. But I know what you're doing. But I don't mind because it's actually going where I wanted to.
Yeah.
Push back.
Yeah.
And then he went young. He went really young and got some high quality players, some good recruitment.
That's a fact. I mean, he deserves a bit of credit because
4 years.
Yeah, to go from part-time to full-time is a real...
Well, he got it badly wrong at Aldershot.
Right, and
he learned a lot from that. I think it actually went too far because he at Aldershot they went full time and he overtrained them and said he started the season with half the team injured.
Yeah.
So his pre-season mantra was always, don't injure them.
Yeah.
And I think probably went a bit too far on that. But he introduced some coaching techniques. Again, Ben Judge in the book talks about that, that they'd never seen before. He insisted on them playing football. You will roll the ball out from the back. Not having any, you know, this is how we play.
Pre-Pep?
Yeah, well.
You know, maybe Pep seen Brownie's team.
And he had bits of luck.
Yeah, you need that.
And also we recruited as the season went on and added to it. I get a bit confused between the promotion seasons, but he brought in a couple of players that made a difference, particularly Khaled Mohammed from, I think he'd been at Bath. He played against us for Bath. Who we needed up front alongside Danny Kedwell. And, you know the story.
Mm.
Penalties at City of Manchester Stadium. Terry had lost two playoffs through penalties. One when he was 3-1 up, and they'd both taken three. Wasn't 3-1 up and, you know, the imbalance. I watched it. I dug out the video on YouTube and watched it. Oh, how heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So when we went to 2 each after three, because Khaled missed his penalty, should never have taken when he had cramp.
Yeah.
I was watching Terry. I wasn't watching that. I was watching him, thinking, "What's going through your head?"
Yeah.
And then Seb Brown made another save, and two more goals from us, and there we were in the league. And one of the things I always enjoyed was the following season introducing this is Terry Brown, Football League Manager, because he'd been so close so often.
Yeah.
And such a nice man. Really
funny guy, isn't he? He's
very
like
funny.
Yeah, but you know, he's another one. You have to be careful that's all you see.
Yeah.
Because he's more astute than that. Let me tell you.
Oh, he is. He's also very straight. I mean, I remember one player we interviewed who went on to play at quite a high level. Terry used to win the Fair Play League. He used to get a bit of flak for promulgating that, but he said it's misnamed. It should be called the Good Discipline League. I don't want players who can't play because they've been booked for, you know, arguing with the referee.
Yeah.
They're not earning me anything on the pitch. They're useless having to pay them. So we used to get that, and we had a player come in who was very talented. And within a couple of minutes of the interview, Terry said, if you come here, we're not having that diving. We are absolutely not having that. You're going to have to cut it out. I thought, frick.
Yeah.
He didn't like it. He didn't like cheats.
Yeah.
Which is to be admired, I think. Then, the end of his first season in the league, where we came probably 14th after a really good start, we fell away. We got the recruitment wrong in the summer.
Yeah. That's massive in football, isn't it?
It's everything. That's at that level in particular. I was surprised when I looked it up again that it was only 7 games in the following season. But in the season, the first season, I think there was a run where he took 3 points from 12 games. It never occurred to us to sack him.
Yeah.
The fans didn't give him a hard time because he got us into the league, still playing decent football, and then he turned it around. My Alan Hansen moment when he signed George Moncur and Billy Knott, aged 18 and 19, and I'd saying, what, are you going to save us with the kids, are you?
yeah.
And he did.
Just on that, you know, we're going to get to the point now where you're going to sack Terry Brown.
Yeah.
You've sacked me. Effectively, it went out as, but it was sacked, which is fine.
By mutual consent.
By mutual consent, yeah. When do you, I understand mine. I understand mine because the deal was promotion in the first year and out of the next division within the next 2 seasons, lost in 2 players. I knew the score, but there was a period in my time there, and I think you went abroad to watch cricket.
And I went to the Ashes in Australia.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, I was never so glad to see somebody go away for a couple of weeks because I'd been in a bad run.
You certainly had, and you went and won at Aldershot. Which saved you.
And then Ebbsfleet as well, wasn't it? Or Ebbsfleet?
It was Gravesend and Northfleet.
Gravesend and Northfleet it was, yeah.
And that was when we ended up with the 18-point deduction because of Jermaine Darlington.
How do you get to that point? How do you get to that point where you go, yeah, he's got to go?
Well, it different things for different people. For me, we used to sit and discuss this with various managers, and I'd always say, don't talk to me about 3 points for the next 2 games or that sort of stuff.
Yes.
I'll know. I don't know how I'll know, but I'll know. And when the moment comes, I'll say so, that I think it's time to go. And I think I was probably the last to say Terry should go. And looking back at it, I'm amazed it was so soon in the season. It was only 7 games.
Yeah.
But
how do you know, though?
You just could not see how he was going to improve that team.
Yeah.
He was going to turn it around. You just couldn't. And I think a lot of the zap had gone out of it. That's what it felt to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, Simon will tell you, he turned up every day. He didn't. He stuck to his guns. He said, we're still going to play football. Even though he knew we had a problem. He knew in pre-season
we had
a problem. I think we got thumped by Reading 7 or 8-1 at home. And talking to him later, which is one of the great things about the club, talking to you, talking to Terry, talking to Neil, he said he thought it was perfectly fair when we did it. He thinks Stuart Cash believes we did it too soon, but we couldn't see him turning it round. And so he went, he came to me the night before the home game against Torquay and said, what do we need to do? And I said, you need to get... classic football, I need to get a result. Well, a loss is a result, isn't it? But you know what I mean?
Yes.
To take the pressure off a bit.
Yeah.
We lost 1-0 when... Seb, and the way that happens when you're down at the bottom, Seb Rand kicked a clearance against, I've forgotten his first name, Howe, against his arse and it went in.
Yeah.
It was quite an ample arse.
You're right. That's what happens. You can't
when
buy
you're
something.
At the bottom, you just get kicked in the teeth or in the arse in this case.
Yeah.
And Simon felt we played okay that night, but it was too late.
Mm.
So the next day, Terry came to a board meeting and we started by discussing terms. And we looked after him because look what he did. Three promotions in 4 years on the worst budgets in the league in each season. Played really attractive football. Mm. One of my favourite stories about Terry is we were playing, I think it was at Cambridge, and we were, a game I missed sadly because he reckons it's the best we ever played, and we were absolutely tearing them apart. And the crowd were shouting, "Bloody long ball Wimbledon." And apparently the Cambridge captain came over and said, "Are they watching?"
Are they watching the same game?
Yeah.
Brilliant. The one story I'll tell you about Terry is...
You can't tell me that story.
No. Is when I was manager of Wimbledon and he'd left Aldershot. And I'd spoke to him a couple of weeks after, you know, just to see how his missus was and that. And he said to me, things hadn't been going well at Aldershot anyway, you know, the team weren't playing
they
well.
They thought they were going to go up and they weren't. They were miles off it.
And he said to me, he says, "Listen, typical," and you've got to put Terry Brown's voice to this. He says, "Listen, if you want any advice, give me a ring, because I'm a genius, you know." He said, "I'm a genius. If you read the Aldershot sort of sites and that, I am now a genius." He says, "3 weeks ago, I wasn't a genius." And such is the life of a football manager and the views of football fans.
He's interviewed, we were followed for the entire Ryman Premier League season of your promotion by a TV programme on Nuts TV.
Yes, I've watched some of them.
So at the very end, he says, "You know, I'm 10 minutes from being an absolute donut. And then we get 2 goals and we go up."
Genius.
"And I'm a hero."
Yeah, and that's him. And he goes and we get that. And I can tell by watching your face, it's never an easy thing for you. And
no, it's not.
The only thing I would say to you is that, you know, if I'm sitting down with you and Terry sits with you and Neil sits with you, it tells you that there's a respect in there that I think you should never forget, you know, because we don't particularly suffer fools, and you've been around me to know that I'm certainly of that ilk. And then Neil Ardley comes into the
stumbled into the process because he actually happened to be in London watching some kids. He thought he might take the Cardiff Academy, where he'd been for 4 or 5 years, settled, enjoying it. And one of our fans saw him and thought he'd come down for the job. Wow. And rang Ivor and said, "See, Neil's in town, we're interviewing him." And Ivor said, "What, really?" So Ivor rang him and got him on the, said, "You know, we're not promising anything, but you're bound to get an interview." And the best story about that is, it was around about that. Do you remember when John Terry got banned for racially abusing a young player?
Yes, yeah.
Well, I, just to see how they deal with it, I threw this question in very blunt industrial language into the interview of, "You got your star striker the night before the big match of the season, racially abuses, obscenely racially abuses." I went through what he said. "Your 17-year-old black left back, what are you going to do?" And what I didn't know, because Neil answered the question easily the best, what I didn't know was that he arrived early for the interview with Neil Cox, his assistant.
Yes.
He went at the gents. And the two previous interviewees came at the gents while he was in a cubicle and they're talking about his question.
Oh, so he'd got prep of it?
So he's got the question. He only told me this 8 years later. I thought, oh, no, he was the best. And he interviewed really well. You know, people talk about the romance of it, but about, you know, well, the idealism, you appoint an ex-Wimbledon person. He was the best.
Yeah.
When I think about it, it was a hell of a risk. But
it never seemed like that, did it? You know, I get what you mean. I'd met Neil on a golf day with Wimbledon down in Wales and stood at the bar with him for, it seemed like a long time, just talking. And it's just easy to talk to and listen.
Very easy to talk
so
to
we him. Sort of became... We get on great from minute one, and still do. You know, I still speak to him, and you know, but it never. I know it's a big gamble when you look at it, but did it feel like that when he walked in the door? Because he always seemed to carry himself.
He carried himself well. He talked well. He was very clear about what he needed to do. But when you look at it again, there's a conversation that he recalls, and Ivor recalls it too. I wasn't there. We were away on, I think it was New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, around about then. Away to Torquay again, and the conversation was Ivor saying, "How are you?" Nielsen, "Why, you do realise we need playoff form to stay up this season?" And Ivor, who's a constant, "I'll be fine," going, "Oh,
yeah."
It happened, we won the next day and started on a bit of a run, but even at the end of January, we're still bottom.
Yeah.
And then he got these. He showed his real mettle, I think, in the recruitment on the transfer window day when he brought in. He talked two players into coming that we'd all given up on, but he just didn't give up. Doesn't give up, Neil, which is a bit of a pain when you're trying to tell him, no, that's the end of it. But actually, to be fair to him, he was one of the only managers you've ever had, you included, who didn't spend all his budget, kept a bit back.
Did you need to put "you included" in that?
Well,
yeah, no,
make it clear. You can edit that bit out.
No, not at all, not at all. And you're talking about different characters now again, because me and Terry and Arch have all had a few beers together, as a get on brilliant as a threesome, but very different people again, aren't we?
Oh yeah, but you all have very high standards of how you should behave and how things should be done and how they're right. And I think I particularly remember that we played Curzon Ashton, the FA Cup, and the cameras were there because there was hope. You know, we were the big team, which is a bit odd for us, but we were. And with 10 minutes ago, we were 3-0 down. And we got the classic 3 goals in 4 minutes or something. And then got the winner in the 90-somethingth minute. And the final whistle, crowd going wild, a lot of people had travelled up. Players, the management team racing on the pitch to grab the players. Neil makes a beeline for opposition manager and hugs him. And I thought, that's class, that's real class. It's let's just look after the important things, because I don't think he'd ever been in the position of feeling like that. He knew how it must feel.
He
did the same, but when we beat Accrington, or drew, but got through at the playoff final against them, we drew that 2-2. That's the first thing he does is out on the pitch, shaking hands with our players.
Yeah.
And one of the things that stuck in many people's mind, I know you're not into cricket, but the Ashes in 2005, which is the best summer sport I've ever seen, including the Olympics, the famous picture of Freddie Flintoff leaning down over Brett Lee, they'd come within three runs of winning the Test match, when it was impossible. And everybody else is racing around celebrating, Freddie Flintoff leaning down, hand on his shoulder. And I thought, that's class.
Yeah.
That's real class. And Neil showed that frequently. And I was so impressed by that, because especially because I'm such a dreadful loser myself. And I would have, if it had happened to me, I'd have really appreciated it.
Yeah, and you always sort of made a habit. I don't think it was ever an agreement or anything in writing, but you were never fussed on speaking to me and anybody else after games.
No, it was deliberate, because my family did not like being in the car with me on the way home after we'd lost. They really didn't. And I thought, I can't just go in and see the manager when we've won. That's just juvenile. That's just awful.
Yeah.
So I made a conscious decision that all I'll do with the manager, I usually do, is poke my head in and say goodnight.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I think it became more of a thing with Neil than you or Terry. If we'd lost and they're all sitting there glum, I just say, look around, count the dead. Anybody die?
Yeah.
No. Well then, let's move on.
It's funny, I used that when I left Wimbledon, when I worked at the other clubs. I used to say to the chairman, let's not speak Saturday night. Because I would advise any manager to do. I thought it was a great thing. I don't know why you fell upon it, or you're a bitter loser and it was wrong to do it. But
I've rationalised why I did it. I think it just, what can you say anyway?
Yeah.
The guys are in their cups, they're sitting there talking it through. I know sod all about football, so the last thing they want is my opinion on why we lost.
Yeah.
Neil was very clear about that. He used to tell me what had happened and how things went. Come the Monday morning, he got around to saying, well, you tell me. Trying to teach me football, which he didn't succeed, but he tried valiantly.
But then, Ards had good success at the club as well, didn't he, you know?
He did. I mean, he got us into, he finally recruited the perfect strike force. You had Adebayo Akinfenwa, man, powerful and strong. Had Tom Elliott, 6'4" and strong, with a bit more pace. Bayo was extraordinarily skillful. Everybody was always surprised by that. Had Lyle Taylor, pace, and just scored goals. And Adi Aziz, who had tremendous pace, and you bring him on with 15 minutes to go, you terrify the life out of people, as indeed we did in the playoff final. He should have got two penalties, but he won one.
Yeah.
Just through sheer pace. And that was such a... Of course, we lost some of them. I think we lost Bayo immediately. He'd been a substitute.
Yeah.
Tom Elliott went, and then Lyle. And then Neil kept us in League One. Because the philosophy that we had was that we could see the new stadium on the horizon then. We needed to be in League One when it came. You know, if you're in League Two and you get relegated, you're in a world of pain, financial pain, and potentially catastrophic going at the conference from League Two.
Yeah.
You're in League Two from League One. It's horrible, but it never has happened. But if it did, you'd survive. You can't. So we needed to stay in League One until the new stadium came.
Yeah.
And now we've got the foundation. We've got the foundation for the community work we do, for improving and extending the team, for making the place just a genuine hub for the club instead of... Kings Meadow was our home for 17 years, but it wasn't really our home.
Mm.
Maybe 18 years, actually. This is the place now, and now we've got the base from which to build whatever it is we're going to build next. Yeah. I don't know what that is, because it's not my choice, but it's a fantastic place to be. Thank you.